Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And who out there knows what it's like to be humiliated like this in your own front yard?
There was another incident where I was getting ready to get into the shower and we started arguing and he actually threw me out of the house and I was naked and it was the middle of the day. And so I had to hide in my car for 4 hours because our neighbor's kids were outside playing.
DeJuan Smith Williams, an NFL wife who watched the violent Ray Rice elevator tape and vividly recalled herself in the same situation being beaten up by her husband, Wally Williams, years ago, who played for the Browns, the Ravens, and the Saints. DeJuan had no dramatic videotapes. She could only try to speak up about what the abuse was doing to her and her family, but no one wanted to hear it. Now, in the wake of all the current NFL scandals, she's come forward again. This time, everyone is listening. DeJuan Smith Williams carries scars and wisdom from what she's been through. She says the pain of domestic violence is never over, and healing has been a slow personal process. DeJuan is separated from her husband right now, her future unclear. The NFL, she insists, has never done anything to help her. DeJuan says now she's trapped with the memories of violence and all the questions from her children.
I think the environment or the culture within the NFL is a culture in which they manage and they look for men that are aggressive on the football field. They are admired for their aggression, for their ability to impose their will on other people. And in that same sense of imposing their will, it's done in the household as well. These men, I know for in particular, my husband was used to getting his way, not used to being told no. And when he hit resistance, anything that would get in his way or would not go according to what he wanted, there was issues. Before he went to training camp, he would say, okay, I'll see you at the end of the season. I'll get with you when the season's over. So, you know, he was a whole different person when he was playing.
What incidents can you recall that were particularly scary and really evoked this sense of, boy, these football players are different than your normal guys?
I can recall probably the first incident that he and I had where we were arguing and, you know, I have a very open and curt mouth and I don't mind speaking my mind. And I spoke up and he charged across the room and he grabbed me by my throat and he held me up against the wall and, you know, he was choking me. At that point, you know, I was pretty much pushed and shoved. I was in my bra and panties at the time. And at that time, you know, I was put in the garage and locked out of the house for several hours. There was another incident where I was getting ready to get into the shower and we started arguing and he actually threw me out of the house and I was naked and it was the middle of the day. And so I had to hide in my car for 4 hours because our neighbor's kids were outside playing. So there were several situations. And then Wally also became enraged at one time. We were fighting about his substance abuse issue that he was having with the league and he became angry and got a baseball bat and was running through the house, hitting the walls, hitting the chairs, hitting the doors. The door to my garage door actually had a perfect circle of where he took the baseball bat and rammed it into the door, and it was locked. I ran up into my room and called the NFLPA liaison that had been assigned to Wally and his diversion program and told him exactly what was going on in my house and that I was fearful and I was afraid and that I needed someone to help me. And, you know, they assured me that they would take care of it and that they would contact me back to check on me to make sure everything was okay. And that never happened.
So what was your understanding that this NFL liaison character was supposed to do? I mean, did they assure you at the NFL that if you ever have problems, we got this under control, you call us, we'll know what to do, we don't want you feeling scared?
We are here for you.
Really?
We want to make sure that we meet all of your needs. We want to make sure that, you know, Wally complies with the program so that we get him back on the football field. Whatever you need, whatever the kids need, you call us. We'll see to it that it gets done. Lip service is great. They're great listeners. But as far as following through with actions, it was, I got listened to a lot, but there was never any action taken. And it was just very disheartening to the point where I finally came to my senses and realized that, you know, pretty much in the league, families, wives, children, we were seen but not heard. We were not first you know, we just weren't the priority at the time. The priority was Sunday's game.
So the NFL may have done everything they could, in your view, on your husband's substance abuse, but they didn't do much at all as far as helping you with the domestic violence question.
Well, absolutely, because their goal at that particular point was to protect the brand. It was to protect the league. It wasn't to protect my husband from himself and his high-risk behaviors. It was all about doing what was best to keep any type of negative impact on the league. That's what they did.
The Ray Rice case, what's your reaction to that? And how do you respond to people who might say, oh, great, so now everybody's coming out of the woodwork to take advantage of this big story, piggybacking on the NFL's profile here to get some attention?
Well, first of all, I'm not here to get attention. I'm here to make a change. And the reason why I'm speaking out is that I feel, for me, this is someone that is experiencing something that is similar to what I have experienced in my personal life, only it's in the public eye. You know, at the time when I tried to make it in the public eye, I was told no one was going to listen to me. No one wants to hear what the F you want to say. No one's going to believe you. I'm the football star. So you get cowered down into not talking, into sharing.
And how do you think Janae Rice has handled this? There seems to be a lot of pressure out there that, you know, she's viewed as someone trapped and that unless she gets a divorce, she isn't really accepting what's going on here. How do you feel about all that?
Janae is doing what any person that has dealt or is dealing with abuse does. She is rounding up, protecting her family, you know, trying to keep the peace within her household to take or divert the attention away from what has happened because they or she has allowed their personal life to roll over into his professional life. And that has hindered his ability to bring income into the home. So she is doing everything that she can to preserve or to protect what is left. We marry these men in the NFL, not because of the money, not because they're professional athletes. We fall in love with a person and we truly want a family. We want to maintain and keep our relationship and keep our household. And when that doesn't happen, it's very difficult to just actually come to the realization and tell yourself and admit that you have failed. Janae will not realize her situation until she's actually removed herself from it. I mean, who lets someone punch them in the face and then marries them a month later?
So if somebody said to you, all right, look, Dawn, you know, we can absolutely assure you that nothing is going to happen in the Rice household again. This is just a one-time incident. It's never going to happen again. What would your reaction to that be?
Based on my experience, I'd laugh just like I just did. It will happen again because, you know, there's going to be another situation that you're not going to agree upon. And the aggression and the rage and the anger is there. If you aren't getting training, it's going to happen again. It will happen again. And based on what I saw in that elevator, the way that he just carelessly handled her body after he knocked her unconscious, it broke my heart. There was no response of any type of urgency to get her help.
What about the management at the NFL? Do you think a clearing house over there is what needs to happen? Is this something that the NFL in its management and the ownership can deal with? Or should this be something that is handled within individual households?
Well, I think it's both. As far as a clearinghouse, you know, 10 years ago, the people that are in charge were not in charge. The same situations were going on. So it is definitely a systems problem. It is not the leadership. They are just continuing on as status quo. Yes, it should also be addressed within the household. If you are providing families with coping mechanisms and educating them with the skills to properly handle stressful situations, because there was no assistance. The people that you did talk to, no one did anything. So after talking to a wall over and over again and the wall doesn't respond, you're not going to talk to the wall anymore. We need to focus on healing at this point. I'm looking to see what is the league going to do to heal this situation, to make it better. These types of situations of abuse and domestic violence, high-risk behaviors have been ongoing. They just have not gotten the media coverage that they're getting today.
Dawn Smith-Williams, you are separated from your husband, Wally?
Yes, we are currently living apart because, again, the verbal abuse, the emotional abuse has been ongoing. It wasn't corrected when he was playing. It still hasn't been corrected. And, you know, it is what it is. You have someone who believes they're a superstar. And what are you going to do to change that? I can only work on myself. I cannot change Wally. I can't do anything for him but change myself. And so that's what I have chosen to do at this point. Our separation will be ongoing until there is a respect for each other that is earned, that is given, that is provided, and that we can present ourselves as friends and as good partners to our children.
And a divorce that's not in the cards at this point?
I've filed for divorce on 2 to 3 other occasions, and you know, we just don't ever go through with it. And Wally has told me that he has never been the person to file. I have always been the person to file. And he said that he has never gone to get an attorney, nor will he ever do it at this point. So I guess we're in a holding pattern.
All right. DeJuan Smith-Williams, thank you so much. Best of luck to you. And we really appreciate you contributing to this conversation here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you allowing me to come and share.
DeJuan Smith-Williams is the wife of former NFL player Wally Williams. They are currently separated and living in different states. We reached out to Williams, the NFL, and the New Orleans Saints, who Williams played for at the time of the abuse, and did not hear back from him or the NFL. The Saints say they have no comment. At one point in the debate last night in the U.S. Senate, it was about whether President Obama could unilaterally make war in Iraq based on an authorization, a so-called AUMF, more than 13 years old. Here's Senator Dick Durbin.
We are living on borrowed time and we're traveling on vapors. AUMFs that were passed in 2001 and 2002 are hard to wrap around today's challenge.
But unilateral action by presidents in wartime has a long historical precedent. A commander-in-chief in wartime can order a nuclear attack without Congress. LBJ and Richard Nixon escalated the war in Vietnam without Congress. And in 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln made one of the riskiest and greatest unilateral decisions in U.S. presidential history. It was a decision that changed the nation forever and completely transformed the bloody battlefields of the North and South. A new book by Todd Brewster tells this story. Lincoln's gamble, the tumultuous 6 months that gave America the Emancipation Proclamation and changed the course of the Civil War. Todd Brewster joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a pretty interesting moment in American history and in the life of one man. Let's just begin at the beginning where you say Lincoln came to the decision that he was going to do an Emancipation Proclamation at a particularly emotional moment at a funeral for a young man.
Well, that's when he announced it to his two closest cabinet members. He had been working on it for some time before that, but in private, in fact, very much in private, in the War Department telegraph office, where he'd pull out a piece of paper while he was following the war as the various dispatches would come in and scribble a few thoughts down and get some language going, and then he'd put it back in his drawer and lock up the drawer. No one really knew about it except for one or two of the clerks there. But on a funeral ride, a carriage ride to a funeral of an infant, the son of Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, Lincoln suddenly reveals to Secretary of State Seward and Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles that he's prepared to issue an Emancipation Proclamation. It was a particularly emotional scene, as you say, and one of the reasons was that Lincoln's son Willie had died only a few months before. And so they're actually in a carriage ride over the same streets to the same cemetery where Lincoln had gone to bury his own son who had died of typhoid, much like James Stanton, the son of Edwin Stanton, had. So the war, his own personal loss, his worries about how to settle this issue of slavery, whether to promote it as a secondary or even a primary mission for the war, this was all contained in this conversation he had in the carriage ride that day.
What's surprising to learn in this book is that the Emancipation Proclamation is on some level a tactic to win the war quickly, that it would constitute an acceleration of the war and its brutality.
The war shifts around 1862, and one of the leading elements is the Emancipation Proclamation. Now it's not just armies fighting against armies. It's armies fighting against societies, against the civil structure, going after the economy, the labor source, and using that as a method of undermining the entire society of the South.
So the Emancipation Proclamation was a chokehold on the labor that supported the South financially. It was also a way of saying, all right, let's have it out. Let's go all the way. And that led to U.S. Grant and Sherman in the tactics that ended the war ultimately years later.
Yes. So one of the arguments for having a brutal war or a hard war is that you stamp out the opposition. It doesn't simmer and rekindle like a fire and start again 2 years later. You wipe it out, which was not as the way wars were taught at West Point. The officer corps didn't believe in this. McClellan did not believe in this. McClellan would not fight a war for slavery. And they had sympathies with the South. They looked upon it as more of a police action, a subtle action, just returning the states to the Union, yes. But there's one more aspect about thinking of it as a war measure that's really, really important. And that is that the only way that Lincoln could exercise this power was in his role as commander-in-chief. In other words, if he freed the slaves, it was essentially a taking. It was the removal of private property without just compensation. So the Constitution would have barred it. But he could exercise this power, and this is what he determined, if he exercised it as part of his war powers as commander-in-chief. And this set up this strange irony because now he was, quote-unquote, freeing the slaves in the South in the places that he didn't actually control, and leaving slavery intact in the border states in the North where he did control it, and therefore and acting on slavery not as a moral question but purely as a military tactic.
And the Emancipation Proclamation, by this analysis, doesn't really deal with the issue of freedom for the human beings who were slaves. They're still considered property, both in the North and South, and this executive order simply frees them like it might take control of, you know, washing machines or cars and driveways.
Well, this is another irony baked into this, is that Lincoln, who abhorred the idea of thinking of slaves as property, had to think of them as property in order to exercise his power as commander-in-chief. And that was the only way he could constitutionally commit himself to this act, which, while a proclamation, you're right, was an executive order. And today we think of proclamations as sort of ceremonial acts, but back then we were thinking of something that was more or less an executive order. And this is why it was important that he follow this up with the 13th Amendment. And, of course, that's the subject of Steven Spielberg's film. Technically, when the war was over, technically the slaves could be re-enslaved, or at least slavery could remain in force in the South because nothing had been done to disturb it.
Who is the Lincoln that you leave us with at the end of this? He's still, you know, in control, and there's much to happen between this moment and his death.
Well, I think what we arrive at from this book is an understanding of the fragility and loneliness of leadership. And for Lincoln in particular, whom we believe, you know, with his greatness, it should suggest that he single-mindedly did the things he knew had to be done for reasons of moral absolutes, when in fact the choice was not that clear for his decision about when, if he should issue an Emancipation Proclamation. We look back on it from the bleachers or after the fact, we think it all seems so inevitable, but the choice was not so clear.
And he retains a sense of skepticism about living with blacks. He doesn't see some diverse melting pot in the future of America.
One of the disappointing things about seeing Lincoln in this period is to see that how pessimistic he was about the future of a biracial America. Like many people in this time, he did not believe in equality. He believed in the end of slavery, but he believed in a very hierarchical sense of the races. And it was his campaign through most of the 6 months and even afterwards to try to find a way to force the black leadership to lead a movement out of America back to Africa, or to settle in Panama or other parts of South America as a way to give up on this notion that America could be a biracial country. Now, part of that was his inherent racism, which we would call it today at any rate, and part of it was also his fear that the damage that had been done by slavery, the bitterness that came from decades and centuries of having been held in bondage, could never be repaired.
Well, he certainly was on to something in that the healing would require a very, very long time, something we're living today.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the other interesting stories in here is that Lincoln, who did not want a war, of course, wanted an end to slavery but would have preferred a gradual, compensated end to slavery. His notion of gradual was very extended. He says to Stephen Douglas in 1858, the final extinction of slavery may take 100 years or more, meaning that it would have lasted into the 1950s. The war probably hastened the end of slavery, certainly hastened the end of slavery, and yet he never could have predicted that.
Todd Brewster, journalist and author of Lincoln's Gamble, the tumultuous 6 months that gave America the Emancipation Proclamation and changed the course of the Civil War. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big brain on bread.
Mr. McLuhan is right here. Yes.
Ray for Guzman is right here, along with Kristen Meinzer, the Movie Date podcast host and co-host. Rafer is also a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, our culture producer right here at The Takeaway. Welcome.
Hi, John.
So let's talk about This Is Where I Leave You, one of the big releases. It's Jason Bateman and Tina Fey. Let's hear a clip.
Hari said you came alone. What happened to Quinn? You didn't split up, did you?
Mm-mm.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know
freak
why
freak accident on an elliptical string.
Goddamn but... antidepressants I'm on, you know? They just obliterate whatever filter I have, mm-hmm. and it's very embarrassing.
She left me.
I knew it! I totally knew that. I'm sorry, but
she slept with my boss, so...
Well, that'll do it.
Yes, it did.
So is this a relationship movie, Kristen, or a family comedy? What is this?
This is a family reunion movie. A family is reuniting around the death of their father. They're sitting Shiva for 7 days. And Jason Bateman is one of the kids in the family. Tina Fey is another one of the kids. Adam Driver. It's a star-studded cast. And the matriarch of the family is Jane Fonda. You couldn't ask for a better cast. Unfortunately, I think some of the movie just falls flat. Some of the characters just feel more like caricatures than fully drawn. I wanted it to be better, even though I just love this cast and I love the book that it's based on.
Seems like it's going for Fockers territory here. Does it quite make it?
It's going a little bit more, I think, for something like The Corrections.
Right.
It's your classic dysfunctional family comedy. There's nothing that original about it, but I would say that the cast really makes it. You know, Jason Bateman, Tina Fey, they're all playing these roles that they're just perfect for. Adam Driver is great in this film. I think there's a real magic and a real warmth to the characters that lifts it just a little bit above the average. I had a really good time in this movie.
So divided view of that movie, This Is Where I Leave You. Let's look at A Walk Among Tombstones, another example of Liam Neeson sort of living this action world of a complicated hero.
I can't let you leave here. They'll kill me if I do.
Who's they, Jones?
The other two.
So what? You're going to stab me now with that big knife?
It's going to bother me, too, for a long time. I know it will.
How much is it going to bother you? I take that knife away and stick it in your neck.
What do you think, Rafer?
Well, that's Liam Neeson doing only what Liam Neeson can. I had high
Remember
hopes
Schindler's
for this.
List when he was Mr. Gentle
that was bad.
Hero guy?
God. Yes, I do.
Stabbing people
this
in the
ring,
neck.
This ring. Now it's this knife. Well, I had high hopes for this because I like Liam Neeson and I like his action films. There's not a lot of action in this film. There's not a lot of mystery. There's not a lot of thrills. What I found to be mostly in this movie was a lot of sadism and really ugly violence against women. I think it's really dark. Yeah. I think its morality is really skewed. He's a former New York cop working for a drug dealer. I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to get behind that character. And I thought it was really sort of sadistic without being thrilling and slow-moving without being smart. And I found the whole movie to be really kind of a disaster.
Kristen?
I didn't think it was a disaster. Some of it was really compelling, and I like the blurry lines between what's good and what's bad. I like those gray areas. But I do have to agree with Rafer. This is unbelievably violent and sadistic to the point of actually it was giving me nightmares that night after seeing it. It's pretty scary.
All right, Kristen, take us through The Maze Runner. What is this about? And we've got a clip.
Young adult novel adapted for the big screen, post-apocalyptic future, trapped in a maze, a whole bunch of teenage boys. Why are they in the maze? Why are they in the maze?
That old formula.
This is all we got. What's out there? We only have three rules. First, do your part. Second, never harm another glader. Most importantly, never go beyond those walls.
Rafer, I want to be a glader.
Do you?
Yeah, it's
a,
I do. Yeah.
Well, then you'd be trapped in a meadow with a whole bunch of boys, and this is really boy territory. I mean, everything here is for the guys, which I think is kind of good because the Hunger Games and Divergent have been all for the women. You know, you get a bunch of boys in the middle of a maze. What are they going to do? They're going to build a tree fort, you know?
Quickly.
Awful. Just, it's, no. I have nothing good to say about this movie.
On the podcast.
We have an extended version of our Simon Pegg interview.
Ooh, nice.
And we also are going to be reviewing Tusk, the new Kevin Smith movie.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, the Movie Date podcast host and co-host. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, John.
Actor Simon Pegg started out his career as a stand-up comedian. But he's much more familiar today. He plays a pretty good whiskey-sucking Mr. Scott in the movie Star Trek Into Darkness.
Well, where are you?
Where are you?
Are you drunk?
What I do in my private time is my business, Jimbo.
I need you to help me out with something. Will you take these coordinates down? 23, 17, 46, 11.
Are you ready? Wait, you don't think I can remember four numbers? You little faith. What was the third one?
Mad and drowning his sorrows in a bar over a dispute with Captain Kirk that made him resign. Pegg says one of the keys to his own personal happiness has been not drinking, a decision he made 4 years ago. Kristen Meinzer is still with us. So, Kristen, did Pegg seem like a happy fellow to you when you spoke to him last week?
He was very warm and very content and very candid and excited about all the big projects he has on the horizon. Obviously, there's another Mission Impossible coming out, number 5. Box Trolls is going to be out in a couple of weeks. And the big one this week is Hector and the Search for Happiness, which is a little bit of an eat, pray, love sort of story for men.
So now let's listen to your conversation with Simon Pegg.
I met with a bunch of psychiatrists. You know, I kind of like, I had dinner, social sort of interactions with psychiatrists, which I felt was more, I could possibly get more out of them than if I was lying on a couch, you know, because they wouldn't have to be so psychiatristy. So it was interesting to sort of get an idea of what they felt their position was as, you know, as medical practitioners and what they thought their profession meant. And, you know, because Hector's a little bit confused because he doesn't seem to be making his patients any happier. He doesn't really respect their problems in a way because they seem so facile in comparison to, you know, what real problems people have around the world. And he's just a little confused. So he decides to kind of take off on this search.
Let's talk a little bit about those problems that you're saying Hector doesn't necessarily respect. We sometimes call those first world problems.
Yeah, it's true. But I think sometimes there's a dictum in the film which says, you know, happiness is not about drawing comparisons or drawing comparisons can make you unhappy. There will always be someone with worse problems than you, but that's not to say that your problems aren't in some way important to you, you know. And there is a particular malaise in modern living when you live in an affluent society whereby you have so much choice and safety and relative ease in your life. You lose sight of what happiness is because you have nothing to compare it to. You have a kind of what monotone emotional state, you know, whereby everything is just comfortable. And true happiness exists in chaos. It exists in a place of uncertainty. It exists more keenly in places of difficulty, which is something we learned and Hector sees as well, going to South Africa, to Johannesburg and into the townships of Soweto, and saw probably more smiles and laughter there than I've seen in, you know, London or Beverly Hills. And that's not to say that they're happier or more comfortable. They're probably not. Their lives are probably more dangerous and more risky. But because they have the entire emotional spectrum, they understand what happiness is far better than people whose lives are just sort of bland and comfortable.
So do you think that that's the lesson that the film is trying to teach us, that the search for happiness is really about experiencing everything? Or is there some other takeaway as far as how we can become more happy?
No, I think there's lots to take away, but I think that's a key one. I think there are lots of dictums in the film that appear along the bottom as captions, and they range from sort of, you know, hallmark platitudes to actually genuinely philosophically weighty stuff. And I think one of the most important ones for me is avoiding unhappiness is not the road to happiness. And that's a key factor, I think, in the notion of happiness, in that it is part of a continuum. It exists alongside all the other emotions. And if you want the rainbow, you have to have every color in it. You know, you have to have the blue as well as the yellow and all that lies in between. And I think it's a key thing to embrace happiness as a as a system. It's not as a destination. You know, I mean, to use the rainbow sort of analogy again, if you chase a rainbow, you'll never get to it. But if you learn to enjoy sort of running, chasing, you might achieve happiness. Happiness is something we experience as a side effect of doing other things, of dancing or you know, swimming or whatever, or cycling, reading. It's something that can it's almost like a byproduct, you know.
So is your definition of happiness different now than before you started making Hector?
I think I have a clear idea of what happiness is. Hector is the story of a man, but it's told from the point of view of a small child, and that child is Hector's sort of inner child, which is an important part of our emotional makeup that we need to maintain contact with at all times, because we have a very pure view of happiness as children. It's unadulterated by cynicism and by experience and by the burdens of being a grown-up, you know, mortality, taxes, all that kind of stuff that weighs us down as we get older. We have a very pure way of looking at the world when we're kids. And if we can somehow keep aligned to that and try and view things through the prism of being a child, it can help you unlock elements of your happiness. You know, like I always try and regard my job, which is a lot of fun, as I would if I was seven. You know, when I got the role in Star Trek, I thought, God, what would my seven-year-old self think of this? He would be absolutely apoplectic with joy, you know.
Screaming and jumping up and down.
Yeah, so I think the key is to kind of almost achieve a sort of vicarious happiness through yourself, through your childhood self, by trying to maintain that perspective. And it's an interesting way. Also, just being kind. Kindness is a direct route to happiness, you know, because you can make other people happy. And in doing so, you make yourself happy and they become happy and they want to make other people happy. And it's a sort of, you know, one begets the other. Tolerance, love, all these things are really, really important in creating happiness. And it's strange that we're partway into the 21st century and we seem to be more unhappy than we've ever been as a species. You know, there's more unrest, more intolerance, more hate knocking around. It's depressing. I mean, we need to engender in our children direct interaction with other people. Interacting with strangers can actually create happiness. You know, if you're in an elevator and it's really silent, say something to the person in there. You'd be surprised how they will respond. You know, it's important. The more insular we become, the more we look at our phones all the time, text each other rather than talk to each other, we're shying away from interaction, and interaction can create goodwill, and goodwill can create happiness.
Simon Pegg speaking to Kristen Meinzer there. He's the star of the new movie Hector and the Search for Happiness, opening in limited release today. People are descending on New York City this weekend. There's the UN General Assembly, and trying to get the attention of all those world leaders will be tens of thousands of environmental activists in a march calling for global action on climate change. On Monday, we'll hear from the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, who says climate change has become a fight for survival in his Pacific nation. Will you be at the march? What would you do first to reverse climate change? Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to listen to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.